Hey everyone, you're listening to the official podcast of 4playernetwork.com. Check us out at that address for everything you need to know about our community, monthly giveaways, and nightly live streams. You can even support us on Patreon at patreon.com/4player. And last but not least, you can catch the live recordings of these podcasts every single Thursday night on our Twitch channel. We hope to see you there. Enjoy. Welcome to the 4-Player Popcorn Cast. This is a special bonus podcast we do here at 4playernetwork.com. I'm your host today. My name is Nick Henderson. I am, of course, joined by Christopher Guthridge.
Hello!
And our friend from across the pond, George Dennison. Hello.
Hello, hello.
And we are going to be focusing today on Blade Runner 2049. Quite possibly one of the most thought-provoking movies I've seen all year. And I think a couple of it, at least I know Crispy and myself actually watched the original Blade Runner on Friday night, so that's kind of fresh in our minds. I'm not sure when the last time you saw it was, George, but we'll talk at length about the new movie and how it connects to that one, and of course we will be spoiling the shit out of this movie, so if you have not seen it, or if you are at all worried about things being spoiled, now would probably be a time to turn it off for a second and come back after you've seen it.
And this is definitely a movie that, like, the less you know...
The better.
...going in, the better.
Yes, absolutely. But there is also a hell of a lot to unpack after seeing this movie. I saw it last night. George just got back from the theater, what, like an hour ago?
Yep.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty fresh in all of our minds. So let's... I don't really know where to begin with this movie because it is... so thought-provoking, and it is so intrinsically tied to the original. But I guess let's...
George, you are, like, still hot off the fucking iron, right? So, what do you think?
You guys sound like you really like this film.
I do.
I'm a bit worried I'm going to be a bit of a party pooper on this podcast, because I liked it. I did like it. Just maybe not as much as it maybe sounds like you guys did.
That's fine. And actually, and to be totally honest, I having watched it last night, I still think I need to watch it a second and maybe even a third time before I fully process the movie. But I've also, having watched Blade Runner only for the second time on Friday, this whole series is kind of a new thing to me. After watching the first one, there's certain things about this series that I really, really appreciate, and it has a tone and it has an atmosphere that I think is super unique and, like, kind of untouched by a lot of sci-fi out there. But it also definitely has, I don't know if I want to call them issues, but there are certain things about it that I think are maybe prevent it from having mainstream appeal. Which is
interesting. It's interesting you bring that up, because I was just looking it up online. Apparently, it's been a box office bomb in the U.S.
So far. I mean, it's only the first day, but yeah, it's definitely... I think it made 30... worldwide, I think it made 31 million on the opening day.
Yeah, this is the third day.
Yeah, so it's definitely not performing up to expectations, but at the same time, you kind of have to wonder... I mean, if I remember correctly, the original Blade Runner was also not a box office success, which is why it's gone on to become such a like a cult classic. The thing that maybe worries me a little bit is that I can't really tell if they were trying to set this up for like with sequel potential, but if it keeps performing the way it is now, I don't think it's going to happen. But
I don't think that the way the movie plays, I don't think that was in mind.
Yeah.
To be honest with you.
I mean, it definitely feels like it could stand on its own.
There are definitely threads that they could follow if they really wanted to do that, but those threads would take you out of what this franchise, that's such a fucking cheap word. what this whole Blade Runner thing is supposed to be about, you know? The big thread that's kind of left hanging at the end of the movie is this, like, impending replicant revolution that Kay kind of, like, stumbles into. And telling a story... Like, that is definitely a story that Philip K. Dick would tell, for sure. And I'm pretty sure some, like, the Foundation novels, I'm not sure, but I think those have, like, a lot of that same kind of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that you would make a Blade Runner movie about that stuff.
Yeah, it seemed kind of, I mean, I don't want to say that it seemed thin, but it definitely doesn't seem like it would have the same, like, that story doesn't necessarily feel like...
It would just be a completely different tone, it would be a completely different...
Like, it wouldn't appeal for the same reasons that I think the story they're telling in Blade Runner in 2049 appeal.
Yeah.
But to be honest, like, I think that might be a good thing. Like, if they can't make any more sequels for financial reasons or whatever, I think that's totally fine. I think Blade Runner and 2049 kind of ultimately, after having seen them both kind of back to back, I feel like 2049 does a pretty adamant, pretty good job at kind of like putting a bow on that story, at least Deckard's story.
Well, sure. Maybe even more of a bow than we even deserved. But the nice thing about this movie is, dude, I don't know. Like, I have to watch them both again, but this one definitely struck me, like, even a little harder than the original Blade Runner did.
You're not wrong. I feel kind of the same way. I
feel like that's kind of maybe a product of the fact that the original one was... You know, the original one existed in such a like chaotic state where it was just like constantly being redesigned and recut and reformed, and some of those cracks kind of show through in the movie itself. But this one, it seemed pretty clear that they had
a clear vision.
They had a direction. They had a goal. They knew exactly what it was going to be from start to finish, and they kept it pretty consistent.
Yeah,
you know,
which is kind of miraculous, especially like it had everything going. It had everything working against it. Mm-hmm. It's been 30 how many years 35 years
30, well
wait it came out in 82
yeah 82 so
yeah about 35 years
35.
since the original, obviously, you know, Harrison Ford's aged quite a bit, but that hasn't stopped him before. And, you know, just in general, like, when you see people, and rightfully so, tend to have a very kind of like knee-jerk reaction when they hear that getting a sequel to a a long dead, or
especially since that's been such a thing lately. Like, it's been such a thing. It's surprising. I mean, it's kind of surprising when one of these like sequel reboots or whatever is even good,
much less,
let alone when it's like fucking art.
Yeah.
Like, which, so, this movie kind of is.
Yeah. Okay, so here's, this is, that's, I'm glad you said that. So one thing I wanted to point out, and this is, so watching the trailers for, you know, since they started, you know, promoting this movie, I thought it looked cool, but you know, part of me was really concerned that maybe, especially after I finally saw Blade Runner 1. I actually didn't watch the original Blade Runner until after I started seeing trailers for 2049, and I was like, okay, I probably should go back and watch this. And I did one thing I didn't know about Blade Runner going into it was that it is a very slow burn, very methodical, and it's not an action movie by any stretch of the imagination, I don't think. It has moments of action in it, but like, I was worried they were going to try and mainstream this bitch up, and like when it came out, it was going to be super fast paced, and more kind of like an action romp. And it was
gunfights, car chases, and I mean, you do get that. You do get a lot of that, but it's all in service to something that's a little more thoughtful.
Yeah.
Than just like rollicking blockbuster adventure.
And man, to see a movie like Blade Runner 2049 come out in 2017 and have them, like, quite honestly, like, they are very true to that original, to the tone and pacing of the original Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
They did not let themselves be tempted into, like, turning it into an action movie, even in the slightest, I don't think. This movie is super committed to, like, the slow panning shots, the dialogue-heavy scenes, the philosophical questions, I guess, that it asked, and all that stuff. Like, all that stuff that was super prevalent in Blade Runner 1 is totally at play here, which I think is great. I also think the movie, it makes for the movie to be, you know, a bit long in the tooth at the end of the day. I think it was 2 hours and 45 minutes, I believe.
Yeah, it's beastly.
Yeah.
I felt carried pretty much the whole way through. There wasn't a part where I was kind of like, I don't know. I'm not maybe the best person for this one, because I really like, when if a movie is going for like a dramatic tone, I really like slow, understated, simmering scenes. I like for these scenes to breathe. I am very much of the belief that, like music, it's not just about the notes, it's about the silence between them too. Yeah. You know?
No, like, I completely agree. And
so when they, like, some of these scenes just like, they just let it hang for a really long time. They let it build, they let it simmer, and I was loving every minute of it, but you know, if that's not your thing,
the thing is, I think it works really well in some scenes and maybe not quite as well in others. I think, like, for instance, the opening scene of the movie where Kay goes to talk to, he goes to question, I can't remember his name in the movie, Batista's character. Yeah. When he goes to talk to him at his farm, that whole scene was like really tense, but like really well done, like very subtle use of music in it. And like,
it's, and the sound design, like, the sound design is on point the whole fucking movie, but that scene in particular, the one sensory thing that I link to that scene is the boiling pot.
Yes.
Because it's just boiling, and you can just hear the lid count, like just resting on top of it as the scene is getting like more tense and more heated, and the gun comes out, and the whole time you just hear the boiling pot, and it's just driving this like psychological action, and it's so well done.
Yeah, I think that whole sequence is beautiful. But then, like, to kind of contrast that with something else in the movie that I think didn't quite work as well, and you may disagree with me here, but like the weird sex scene with him, with Kay and his...
Oh my god, that blew my fucking mind. That was so cool.
I think it was cool. I think
that scene... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Conceptually, I think that scene is a really cool idea. I think the execution of it was a little long and awkward.
No, I mean that scene. Okay. Joy, the holographic girlfriend, is like kind of the biggest thing that's like really fucking with my head the whole time, because, and that scene kind of cements like a counter argument to an opinion that I have about that character. Okay.
Yeah.
So that scene in particular is really interesting to me because it kind of shows evidence against what I think that character kind of is. And I mean, I'm sorry, I'm rambling because I'm getting all fucking crazy about this movie. But the thing about that character is the whole time, the whole movie, she is there for him. She's like very loving. She's very supportive. She makes you believe, when she's on screen talking, she makes you believe that she's a real person with some semblance of like emotional agency and that she loves Kay.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, you believe it. But the movie keeps slapping you in the face and going, no, she's not a person. She is a program. She's a thing designed to do this, designed to fake this very well.
And
her performance and like her motives and the things that she does makes you believe like, oh no, I think she's transcended that. I think she's more than the sum of her parts. And then the movie slaps you again and says, no, she's not. She is this thing. She's a very sophisticated thing, but she's still a thing designed to do one thing, and it's what she's doing in the movie. And just having that little like aside going on with Kay's struggle of being like, am I a replicant? Am I this like natural born messiah baby? What does it mean? What does it even fucking matter? Like, having breaking that up with this other smaller kind of internal debate, this internal conflict of like, is this hologram a real person? Does she count? Like, we all feel like, okay, Kay's a person. Even if he's a replicant, he's still a person and deserves some empathy and deserves some respect as a being, right?
Yeah, and I think one thing that kind of accentuates that argument too is the fact that like they created this holographic person to keep him happy, and like he lives in an apartment like a person, even though everybody knows he's technically quote unquote not a person. Like the whole world seems way more comfortable with the idea of replicants as people than it did in Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner.
They've become more sophisticated, and they've kind of
ascended beyond,
gained
that
a little bit of agency compared, like, so Kay is a Nexus 9, right? And the replicants in the first Blade Runner were Series 6, And they weren't supposed to have emotions at all. They were only supposed to live 4 years. So replicant existence has kind of broadened a little bit. It's kind of opened up a little bit. They, like, he owns an apartment now. Like, he has a life outside of his work kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he's still very much, like, not a regular citizen of society, you know? He's still very much not really a part of the system.
Yeah.
As a person.
I honestly think... And when I talked about that, the sex scene not working as well in my head, it was more like I still do think the questions that they're posing and the philosophical argument they're making and the actual idea and the content of all of that, I think, is really well done. I think for me, that one scene in particular just went on maybe a little too long. It was more of just an execution of that scene than what they were actually trying to accomplish with it. But also, like, did some cool stuff that in that scene.
Like, what I was getting at earlier, the reason why I really like that scene is because it's the one thing that I can point to say, like, well, I don't know, maybe Joy does have feelings. You know, she, like, after that whole thing's over, she tells, I can't remember the pink haired girl's name.
The prostitute girl, right? She was a prostitute, right?
Yeah, she was a prostitute. I don't remember her name, but she's basically just like, okay, I'm done with you. Get out.
Yeah.
You know, like you feel this kind of like defensiveness and this territorialness coming from Joy. But then you have to wonder, like, I mean, is that just part of this algorithm that she's running to, you know, simulate love, you know, is that part of it? And is the simulation so, like, is it so complex and so comprehensive that, like, maybe it doesn't even really matter? Like, maybe she isn't actually capable of loving, but she's capable of simulating it so well that, like, it's not even an issue. And in which case, if you can create a computer that can completely simulate something like that, I mean, what does it mean for a human to be able to experience emotions like that? Yeah. I mean, it all keeps folding back in on itself, and I've just been, like, pounding my head against a wall for 2 days with this. But I really love that scene because it's the one thing that I can, like, kind of hang the whole, like, Joy is a sentient, intelligent creature.
Well, actually, okay, so the one scene that did that for me that was not the sex scene was actually the very last scene that Joy is in when they're having the scuffle in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And the other robot goes over to crush her, the device that she gets travels in now after she's been unplugged from the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she can see that she's about to be killed, essentially, when she goes to crush it, and she just turns to Kay and she says, "I love you," and that's the last thing. And, like, but that was where I was like, she just recognized that she was about to die.
Yeah, but if she exists to love Kay because she was made that way.
Yeah,
I mean, wouldn't that just be part of it? Isn't that something she would do? I mean, she's just running a program.
One of the interesting scenes I thought that worked really well with the whole sort of plot of the film was there's that scene after she dies and then he's there on the bridge or whatever it is, and there's that giant hologram that kind of advertises it. And I think what isn't one of the taglines of the advertising that it tells you everything you want to hear or something like that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. It says everything you want to see, everything you want to hear. And that comes up at least 3 or 4 times in the movie. And it usually follows a scene that he's just shared with her. You know, like, he has this scene, you buy it, like, you believe her, you believe that there's this connection, that there's this real thing between them, and then you're flying around Los Angeles and all these billboards that are just like, it'll tell you whatever you want to hear, whatever you want to hear. And we know that Kay wants to feel loved. He wants to feel family. He want like that is kind of the whole, his whole motivation in the movie, you know?
Yeah. So, go ahead.
And that ties in really nicely with why he ends up sort of believing that he's this sort of special chosen one, when actually it turns out he's not. And it's partly because he's being driven on by this fake person who is designed to sort of tell him all the things that he wants to hear and wants to believe. So that's
sort of designed to buy it, to, like, play into these emotional fantasies.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Because, like, she was totally encouraging those thoughts that he was the one. He was, like, the Messiah.
He was the one, like, I don't know what this means, and she's like, oh, I think this is it. It means you're special. And then she's like, you should have a name. Like, you're a human. You should have a name. Your mother would have named you. Like, she's just fucking with his head because she's just this echo chamber that's designed to to mimic empathy and emotion to him, you know? And, yeah. and it's really kind of fucked up.
I guess the bigger question I have right now is, obviously there's a lot of different threads in this movie and joy is a big part of it, but like how, like what exactly, so they're trying to make a point about, like this whole thing is kind of about this idea of like, are replicants people or not, right?
Right.
So, but in the grand scheme of things, and as far as the story goes, like the beginning, middle, and end of the story, does she only serve the purpose of kind of driving that point home about replicants or non-people being actual people, or does she have a bigger role to play in the actual arch of the story, right? Because at the end of the day, like how much impact does she actually have after he realized, you know, after he realized, okay, I'm not the kid I've been looking for. It kind of negates everything that she was telling to him. He just kind of accepts, oh, okay, it wasn't me. But then his motivations change, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, his whole thing kind of becomes, he gets wrapped up in this question of like, who is this kid? This kid is important. This kid's really special. Maybe I'm this kid. And then he gets like gut punched with the realization that like, no, you're not this kid. You are this thing that was made to do a job that you do, you know? And then his value in that moment doesn't come from, you know, the circumstances of his birth, to borrow a phrase. Yeah. It comes from his ability to make a choice about what he's going to do. And he makes a choice and that kind of supplants the whole kind of Campbellian child of destiny thing. It's not, because it's not about the whole idea of being born into a great destiny too, is also about robbing one of agency, of choice, of the things that make people human. That impetus, that like turn in motivation from them has to come from a choice made in the face of truth. Yeah. You know, he knows what he is. He knows the score. He knows he's not special. It doesn't matter that he's not special because he can choose, you know?
But yeah, when he did think he was special, he realized that he can choose, right? Right.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, so I just realized we kind of got ahead of ourselves and we didn't really like lay out the over. I mean, right. I don't think it's necessarily that super important to lay out.
I would hope you've seen the movie if you're listening to this.
Yes. So just to kind of rewind back to the very beginning, one thing that I was really impressed by, like, I made it all the way to the theater, having watched a bunch of trailers for this movie, and I felt gut punched when I found out that Kay was a replicant. I had no idea going into that theater that Ryan Gosling played a replicant.
And it kind of makes all those trailers make a little bit more sense.
Yeah,
too,
I think people were commenting on like, he never emotes, like he's a very like straight faced character, and I was like, well. That's because
And it's so beautiful too, because like the whole movie he's kind of like that, except for like the one scene he's not, and that scene is so much more powerful because he's finally just like acting like a, you know, like he finally just like can't control emotions, you know.
Yeah,
and that's the first time you really see him just like lose his grip like that.
And I thought it was really cool too how they actually kind of gave that information away in the beginning of the movie. So when he's in the room, he's questioning Dave Bautista, and then of course a scuffle breaks out, and then Dave Bautista like grabs him by the head and starts smashing his head over and over again into a wall. And I remember thinking in my head, well, unless he's a replicant, he's fucked. Yeah. And then like the next scene, like the next line out of his mouth is, "How does it feel hunting your own kind?" And I was like, "What the fuck?" Like that was a bomb, and I thought that was a really cool way of dropping that information. Because not to mention, it's like we knew going into this that Ryan Gosling was a Blade Runner. But like, I didn't even stop to think about
that he's a Blade Runner who's also a replicant. I mean,
just the fact that like, like 30 years or so have passed since the events of the first movie, and like they've come so far as to entrusting these duties to replicants themselves, which is just
But that's like, that's kind of harkening back to the whole major question of the first movie: is Deckard a replicant? And you know, the final cut went back and made changes to kind of imply more seriously that yes, Deckard is a replicant. And honestly speaking, it's a contentious topic, maybe just to me, maybe everyone in the world thinks that it's a great idea for Deckard to be a replicant. I personally have always fucking hated that idea. I've hated it. Mm-hmm. I just think it doesn't really serve any purpose in the story, and it undercuts what is so great about the ending of the story. It undercuts like this thing that happens with Roy at the end, you know? Yeah. That if Deckard's just a replicant, then okay, that's kind of fucking useless. Like, who fucking cares? And I was really, 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 really nervous going into this movie that they were just going to flat out run with that and confirm it and just be like, oh yeah, he was a replicant. We're taking that assumption and we're building from there. But they didn't really do that.
And honestly,
they throw it out a few times. They definitely put it out there. They have Gaff. They have fucking Edward James Olmos come back as his character Gaff from the first movie. And he says, kind of in an opinionated manner, like, I think, but he kind of puts it out there like, yeah, I don't think he's human. I think he's a replicant. But they don't ever confirm that. And they put out just as much leeway that he's not, you know?
And honestly, I may not be in the same camp as I think it would be a terrible idea, but I think I like it better with the ambiguity of like...
No, I think that I just mean it's a terrible idea in the context of the story that they tell. The way they tell the story, the way that story flows... confusing it or muddling it with Deckard also being a replicant doesn't kind of work. There is a thread like that in the original book in it, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? There's a part where he has to prove that he's human, but he does, you know, and then they kind of leave it alone, but it's just to kind of get you thinking about like, oh wow, these things really aren't that different from people, you know?
Yeah.
To lay the whole like kind of emotional crux of the movie on that though, I think is a mistake. But that's just me. But it is a great idea, and I think it's wonderful that they took that idea and applied it to this new character and went fucking hog wild with it.
Yeah,
you know, it works so well.
And I think there's even a few lines or a few parts in this movie once Harrison Ford actually does come back onto the scene, and like there's a few things like by the end of this movie, technically you could still sit there and wonder, well, was he a replicant or not? But like,
yeah, I defy you to tell me one way or the other.
I know. And like one of my favorite parts in the movie, like favorite lines or uses of a line in the movie, I think was when Kay looks at the dog and he goes, is it real?
And he says, ask him.
Ask him. Yeah.
That is fucking Blade Runner. Oh, I don't know.
Thought that was beautiful.
That's great. That is exactly the answer I want. Like, I don't know. I think it's weird sometimes because if you grew up like in the 80s, 90s, there was this big trend where like any movie that was big and popular got fucked to death, you know? It got turned into cartoon shows, it got turned into merchandising. Like, we have this fucking, we're kind of like trained culturally to want stories to keep going, to want these, because you get so invested in the character that you want them to like have a good life and you want to see the whole thing, you know, and you want them to go on so many different adventures and so many different stories that like it kind of muddles and confuses and diminishes the original context of where that character came from, you know?
Yep.
And we kind of get averse to endings that don't answer questions. We get averse to endings that leave our character stabbed through the abdomen, laying on a set of steps going, well, is he dead? Like, what happened? You know?
Yeah.
But I think it's okay in this context, in this story. Kay's story ends when he brings Deckard to that laboratory. Whatever he does with the rest of his life, it doesn't matter. Whether he has a life, whether he just fucking bleeds out and dies there, it doesn't really matter. His contribution to the greater whole is done.
Yeah,
you know,
he served as his ultimate. It's funny, like his story starts out so grand, like it seems so grand, especially when you start to think that maybe he's this child that was born from a human and a replicant, and then when you find out it's not, his ultimate contribution to the overarching story is to reunite Deckard with his daughter.
Yeah,
which is fine. I think that like it doesn't need to be.
And then what does he do? What does he do after that? Does he continue working as a Blade Runner? Does he join this underground resistance movement? Does he just quit and move somewhere? Like, it doesn't really matter. I don't know that I want to hear those stories because this one was so good and it was so perfect and it exists in this like static moment in time. And honestly, I don't want anything else touching it, you know?
Yeah. So Prince of the Universe, who's watching us live or listening to us live, says, "Damn, I assumed he died. I had never even considered that he may have lived, and now I'm going to be thinking about that." And the crazy thing is, I actually read an article where they were talking about kind of their take on the whole ending and or the whole movie as a whole and how it contributes to the Blade Runner universe or whatever. And they wrote their article under the assumption that he died on those steps, and they don't really concretely say whether he died on those steps.
Yeah, I think, feel like that kind of assuredness, that sense of conviction one way or the other is misplaced.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I think it's just as valid either way, really.
Yeah, and there's also like what so it culminates with Deckard being reunited with his daughter. He meets her for the first time, and then it cuts to black and the credits roll, and you're kind of like,
okay.
Now
I'm so glad they didn't try to have that conversation either. Like, how do you even approach that? Like, oh, by the way, your mother was a replicant. Like,
yeah. Also, like, sorry, this is kind of off topic, but that kind of reminded me too when I was trying to think of scenes that I think there were like a small handful of scenes in this movie that I think could have been shortened a little bit or maybe tightened up a bit, and I think one of them was the orphanage scene. Mm. I think the part where he finds the wooden horse was great, and I think that was super important to the overarching thing of the story. But like the whole walking through the sweatshop and like having that conversation and like intimidating that guy, and then I think that was all drawn out maybe a bit too long.
Maybe in retrospect, I mean,
again, too, I do want to watch the movie again.
Meant to think like, oh, this is where he came from, you know?
Yeah.
And they're really kind of just showing you like. They're really laboring the point of like, this is fucked up. And you know, maybe he's kind of falling out of the frying pan and into the fire a little bit with his whole backstory, you know? Like, he might not be a replicant, but he might be kind of a more human equivalent.
I think this is also just a really interesting thing that I've noticed. And I don't know if this all stems from maybe the source material of Philip K. Dick and people have just latched onto it. But like, I think it's really interesting that so many of the, like, turning points of these stories and both of these movies have relied so heavily on like small wooden or folded pieces of paper that look like animals. Like there's the unicorn from the first one. This one has a wooden horse. It's not the same thing, but like,
well, it also has in Gaff's scene. He also does another little origami, but it's different from anyone that he did in the first movie. Do you remember what he makes in this one?
Was it a dog?
It was a sheep.
Oh, it was a sheep.
The sheep.
Well, there we
which
go.
I mean is probably an allusion to the original source material.
Yeah.
Do androids dream of electric sheep? It could also, you know, it could also be maybe Gaff subtly conveying his opinion of people like Kay, you know?
Yeah.
He's just a sheep. He's just a part of the flock, you know?
Yeah.
You can read into it all day and maybe none of it means anything, but it's certainly fun to talk about it.
It is certainly fun to talk about it. I do eventually want to talk more about just our overarching thoughts on the movie, but there's a few other things. I kind of want to just touch on a few scenes that I think, like, maybe talk about some of my favorite scenes in the movie. I know, so Prince of the Universe says his two favorite scenes were the end, where he drowned love in the water, and that scene after he met the memory girl and got arrested and had to do the baseline test and failed, which reminds me, the baseline test.
It's so good. And do you know what that, I was reading up about this. Do you know what that's from?
No.
What the actual like dialogue of the baseline test, which is, where is it? "And blood, black nothingness began to spin, a system of cells interlinked within cells, interlinked within cells, interlinked within a stem."
So
like
no,
all
I don't.
Of that comes from a book called Pale Fire.
Mm-hmm.
Which was written in 1962 by a man named Vladimir Nabokov. And from what I understand, it is largely considered to be like one of the first big pieces of metafiction, because the whole novel is presented as a 999-line poem written by a fictitious author. And it has like a fictitious foreword and I think something at the end too. But it's a really... there's probably a lot more to unfold there with deeper exploration, but you should look it up and do some reading on your own.
So another question about that test, and so first of all, I think that scene was really cool, like the concept of the baseline test was cool. I wasn't entirely sure how the test worked.
By the way, another fucking brilliant example of this movie's sound design. Like, if those scenes don't like just make your skin crawl.
Oh yeah, they totally do.
I don't know what to tell you. But the baseline test was very similar, or probably some sort of successor to the Voight-Kampff test, which they kind of obliquely explain in the first movie, and it's basically just kind of supposed to be. It's supposed to trip you up.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be like evoking emotional responses. It's supposed to get you to a point where you're not responding from your higher brain functions, but you're responding from an emotional level. And whether or not you can...
Which in the first
place... Well, the Voight-Kampff test was all about whether or not you could do that. But this baseline test was more about... You have him recite something. You have these really aggressive call and response phrases, and you monitor his emotional response to make sure that like whatever trauma that he's just endured doesn't have him feeling too much, you know?
Yeah.
So like while he's doing this, they're asking him like really combative, emotionally based questions, like how does it feel to have your hands linked with someone you love, interlinked, and then he has to like respond interlinked quickly, you know?
Yeah.
So
they're looking for hesitation and
right.
That kind of stuff.
Right. Like, are you thinking about this? Are you getting tripped up about this? You know? And it's fucking, oh my God, it's fucking gorgeous. I love it. I love it so much. It actually reminded me a lot of a bit from Venture Brothers, where they had this room with this nozzle. The nozzle is calibrating. Like, if you ever watch Venture Brothers, it was a late season episode, but it was really good.
Let's see. So I guess I just want to hear. So I do want to eventually touch on George's, because I know George's opinion of the movie might differ from ours quite a bit. Yes, so I do want to cover that.
I've been ranting.
But before we get to maybe that, I just, what are some of y'all's favorite scenes of the movie, just in general?
God, like
I know there's a lot to the
single one.
Yeah,
some of the cinematography is just so fucking good. Like. Las Vegas in general, like when he first got there, was so good.
What the fuck is the point of the bees?
Okay, so there's a part in the movie where a bee lands on his arm, right?
Yeah.
If you think back to the first movie, one of the Voight-Kampff questions that Deckard asks Rachel is, oh. A wasp lands on your arm and she's like, I immediately kill it, you know?
Oh my God.
And Ryan Gosling, who is a replicant, doesn't do anything. Like, he just looks at it.
Wow.
Yeah,
I didn't even remember that. So we haven't really talked about Jared Leto's character.
That's probably one of my favorite scenes. Is Jared Leto's very very creepy character. Very
yeah, creepy. So I watched the two out of the three short films that came before the movie. The first one I watched actually focused on a conversation. With Jared Leto's character. So neither one of y'all have seen that one, right?
I haven't.
No. So in that short film, Jared Leto's character, something Wallace, I can't remember his first name, it's kind of a weird name. But he is essentially kind of like, he is what Tyrell was in the first one, but he has gone above and he has gone beyond what Tyrell did, and his goal is to like help the human race expand into the stars, but he's doing it by using replicants, and he has found a way to create replicants that obey unconditionally, mm-hmm. which is why I guess people have become more comfortable with using replicants, I guess even to become Blade Runners themselves, like that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But this conversation in the short film is Jared Leto meeting with
Neander Wallace is his name.
Yeah, that's right. Neander Wallace, and he's meeting with these, I guess they're politicians of some kind, they're lawmakers or something, and they're having a conversation about whether or not it's right to use replicants, or whether it's okay or safe or something. And he has like a bodyguard with him, and at some point in there he's talking about how they obey unconditionally, his new ones, and they're like, how do we know that? And then he's like, step forward, and then his bodyguard steps forward, and you realize, oh fuck, his bodyguard's a replicant. And then he says, take out your knife, and he pulls out like a big knife, and he says something like, in the next 10 seconds or in the next 5 seconds, kill me or kill yourself. It's your choice. And like everyone's all freaking out, everyone's sweating, and then the 5 seconds later, the replicant kills himself and like stabs himself in the throat and falls over. And he's like, he's basically making a point about his replicants obey unconditionally, and they, if you tell them not to harm you, they will not harm you. And he's programmed to not harm anybody. And so even when I presented him with the choice, he chose himself, killing himself over killing a person. And I thought that was a really effective, like that got me like really excited to watch the movie, because I think Jared Leto's character was super creepy. And I think his every time he's talking on screen, I thought that was really, really just, it gave me the fucking willies.
Yeah, I love that line he has. I can't remember what it is, where he's like, "We lost the appetite for slavery," or something like that. The way he said it,
somewhere along the way.
Yeah, where it basically kind of implied that, like, we could use them as slaves, or like we used to use slaves, like no big deal, but now people have lost their nerve, so let's just use replicants. And it's just kind of like, ugh, is that how you feel about it? That's kind of a very weird.
He's much more flippant about the whole issue than Tyrell was.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Tyrell was definitely, definitely had his moral druthers, but he wasn't as fucking just like evil as Niander Wallace is. It's like, I mean, and he seems, judging from what you've told us about the short film and from what happens in the movie, he seems to have no problem brutalizing replicants.
No, not at all. He sees them almost exclusively as slaves, which is weird because he named his main replicant servant Love, which I thought was really maybe ironic.
I was wondering if that maybe tied more into his whole angel thing that he keeps, harping on. Like, he likes to think of himself as God and as the replicants of his angels.
Yeah.
So, like, every time Love enters the room, he's waxing biblical about angels entering the kingdom of heaven and bullshit like that.
Yeah. Also, one scene that kind of blew my mind in a way was the scene where Neander Wallace is sitting down in the room with Deckard.
Mm-hmm.
And then he brings in a replicant made to look exactly like Rachel.
Oh yeah.
Holy shit. That was some incredible seed, like whatever they did. That's like the first example I can think of where they tried to like recreate someone who's clearly much younger, much older now, like recreating them with obviously with some CG work in there. But like that
was,
I couldn't tell the, like, that was the first time I didn't think it looked weird or awkward.
Because they did what Star Wars didn't do.
They used an actual actor, and then
they most of her dialogue, you're not looking at her face.
Yeah.
So you're not seeing her face move while she's talking too much, and she's only in the movie for, 30 seconds instead of being like the third build character in the film. You know.
Yeah. But it was still really impressive and really convincing. It was that was actually a really powerful scene too, when he said her eyes were green and he turns from, like, steps away, and then Neander Wallace just pulls out a gun and just fucking blows her brains out right there. That was, oh man, that was cool. It was rough. It was a cool scene.
Right.
Yeah, it was rough.
Well done, but it was a rough scene.
Yeah. So Brad also mentioned, I get to that, I guess let's talk about maybe some of the stuff we didn't like about it. I'd like to talk to George for a second about, so the movie didn't necessarily impact you the way it maybe impacted me and Crispy. So what were your overall thoughts on the movie and where did it go wrong for you?
I liked the film. I did. I thought, so I'll say that I thought it looked absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
I'm really glad I saw it in the cinema because I actually haven't been to the cinema in like 2 years.
There's, oh, wow.
Or maybe like a year, I'm not sure. But these big films always come out and then I forget to see them in the cinema or whatever, or don't get around to it. And then I see them on like DVD or on streaming and it's like, oh shit, like Mad Max. I didn't see that in the cinema.
Oh.
Kicked myself for not seeing that.
Yeah.
So this, I'm really glad that I saw it because it's the huge like panoramic shots of them flying over the city and all of that, I thought just looked absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the sound design. And it, when it got to the end of like 2 hours and 45 minutes, it didn't necessarily feel like I'd been sat there for that long. So yeah. it worked for me on some level, definitely. I guess I don't know if there's one thing that maybe didn't resonate as much as, but I guess one thing we haven't talked about that I might just bring up here is, so in your guys' opinion, who was the main antagonist? Because I kind of thought it was Love was maybe the closest, and she, compared to in the original Blade Runner with Roy Batty and
yeah.
his character at the end kind of proving that he was maybe, he had like a human element when he sort of rescues Deckard from falling off the building, and there's that brilliant Tears and Rain monologue,
yeah,
which is probably one of my favourite film scenes of all time. And in this one, I just thought that, is it Love? Is that what she's called?
Yeah, Love is her
main assistant.
Yeah.
She's just kind of like 100% evil. She's just sort of there, you know, killing Kay's girlfriend under her heels. And there wasn't really, she felt a little bit two dimensional. I wonder if maybe that was one of the reasons why I felt the conflict wasn't as interesting. But I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, one thing I want to, first of all, I think you're right, but I wonder if what they were going for was, so I kind of feel like the overall antagonist of the film was kind of Neander Wallace, but they were doing, like, everything that he was doing was being committed via Love. And I almost feel like, and this, I could be wrong on this, but I kind of feel like Love was kind of infatuated with Neander Wallace and was constantly trying to earn his approval or affection, and it's almost kind of like she was doing everything out of,
she buys into his god complex,
yeah,
like super hard.
So I kind of feel like the main antagonist is maybe a combination of Neander Wallace and Love.
I you know, you, if you're looking for a character to point to and say that that's the antagonist, I would say Neander Wallace. Love is an instrument of that.
Yeah,
I think,
but I don't think that really accurately completely sums up the conflict of the movie. I mean, I think the conflict of the movie, like the antagonist is Kay. The antagonist is society. The antagonist is just like, it's as much a man versus society story as it is any like man versus man, man versus machine, anything like that.
Also,
you know what I'm saying?
Daniel in chat says that you could also maybe look at the chief, the cop, the police chief, which was played by Robin Wright, as kind of a bad guy because she was trying to cover up this discovery.
Yeah. She was definitely an agent of the status quo, a status quo that kept the protagonist in an inferior position. So yes, she had some very questionable motives, but also at the end, she kind of cuts him some leeway to do what he's doing, you know?
Yeah.
And then dies for it.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of redemption there. I wouldn't say she's the main antagonist. I would say that she's more just like a force that he has to deal with, and that she kind of comes around in a way. I really think that there's people chasing him and things exploding and people shooting guns, but the actual conflict is between Kay and his past.
Yeah.
Of what is it, you know?
Yeah. I think maybe it's because there's more fleshed out characters. The fact that Love felt to me a little bit two dimensional maybe stuck out a little bit more.
Yeah.
She really is just pure evil, just like, you know.
She does, but you know, she's really no more evil than, she's really no more one dimensional than Neander Wallace is.
Yeah.
You know, he holds a lot of power in a lot of the scenes that he's in. He, you know, to borrow another term, he wins a lot of the scenes that he's in.
Yeah.
But he's very, very one track mind. He's very singularly focused on this grand vision of humanity that requires this expendable force, you know? So he doesn't have a lot of variance in motivation. He doesn't really arc at all. He just kind of gets to do this creepy wizard thing the whole time, and she's the evil henchman. I mean, you know, yeah. And I think that like she's definitely one of the least kind of self-actualized replicants that they've shown in either movie. You know, she definitely has a role and she just plays it.
Yeah.
I don't know that she's... I just don't know that she's really all that one-dimensional. Like, I think there are... I think they don't really open it up and show you as blatantly, but I think there are subtle hints and there's little cues throughout the movie that's like, she's not just, you know, she's not just following orders. She's a zealot. She's like executing, she's executing a crusade that she thinks is her purpose, you know?
She's kind of one of the main reasons I think I want to watch it again already. I want to look for some of those cues, because I certainly think they're there. But to kind of comment on what George was saying about maybe not having an easily identifiable antagonist, I certainly think maybe that is, like, so there was something kind of nagging about me after I walked out of the theater, and I certainly enjoyed the movie a lot, but like that may have been one of the things that also kind of bothered me, because I think especially with Roy Batty.
Yeah,
you're right. Like that scene, like there just wasn't anything necessarily that compared to that scene on the rooftop at the end of.
Yeah.
And maybe that was kind of disappointing, but at the same time, I feel like there's so much ground covered in this movie, and there's so many thought-provoking questions that are asked, and so many really well-done scenes that it didn't really matter much to me in the end.
One really small thing that I picked up on, I don't know if you guys picked up on this, not just like a small niggle for me, is that at the end, I don't know, the Tears in Rain like theme or whatever, the music was played just like it is in the first film, which I think, I don't know, that rubbed me the wrong way a little bit, because that scene, as good as it was, didn't have the same emotional impact as the original from the original Blade Runner. So
where did they play it in this one?
At the end when he's dying on the steps.
Oh, okay. Oh. Gotcha.
During the snow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't pick up on that, to be honest with you. But
I didn't even notice they were playing music.
And, you know, maybe you think that this is just, you know, a bit of a lame jerk off or whatever, but I think that scene is understated, and it's not really going to be something that a lot of people are talking about years and years, but, like, I fucking, just the imagery of him laying on the snow-covered steps with the snowflakes falling. I mean, think about all of just the loaded literary imagery that comes with snow. You know,
yeah.
And not just snow, but also its relation to rain, which was the big environmental cue from the first movie that kind of like wrapped up Roy Batty's whole thesis with the tears and rain, you know?
Yeah.
The tears and rain was this idea that like a teardrop and a raindrop are two different things, but you can't distinguish them, and one is lost within the other, just like replicants are lost within the image of humanity, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas snow represents, well, first of all, it represents more of a moral purity because, you know, it's white. And the snowflake has always been like, I mean, we've heard it a lot lately. It's the symbology used for unique, special things that really aren't that special compared to all the other snowflakes, you know?
Yeah.
The snow kind of more succinctly sums up what Kay is going through than what Roy was going through, you know, but they both echo each other, and they both resonate with each other. I don't know, man.
I certainly think that was intentional.
It definitely lacks a bit of overt punch, but like, I think it is a mistake to overlook that.
Yeah. Also one thing I wanted to bring up, maybe one of the things that kind of, again, something, not a scene that I didn't like, but also a scene that I maybe felt could have packed more of a punch in the end, is basically the entire concluding fight, I guess, where they're in where the car is sinking into the water, and, you know, he drowns Love in the water. Like, that scene, I don't know, I felt like they could have gone for something a little more. I don't want to use the word epic, because I don't think that kind of epic action scene has a place in this movie necessarily, but there was just something that felt a little anticlimactic about that. especially the way he just drowned her in the water, and then, like, not to mention that boat was, or the car was, like, sinking underwater for, like, 10 minutes. Definitely was not my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, but honestly, the same thing, like, I also kind of felt, like, Peter, the first Blade Runner, I felt kind of peters out, and maybe an un... I mean, not to under, like, I don't want to downplay the importance or the awesome scene that was the, you know, Tears and Rain monologue at the end of the first one, but, like, everything leading up to that, I wasn't a huge fan of, to be totally honest. And this one just felt kind of weird because it was them, like, fighting in water and then that boat, the car sinking for, like, 10 minutes, and then he just drowned love in the water. It just felt a little anticlimactic to me, but certainly not something I hold against the movie.
I think one of the things, and this isn't just this film, it's kind of a complaint I have with a number of films, is when they're replicants and they're getting, like, smashed around a lot. I know that they can die, and eventually if they take enough damage or whatever, or presumably they die like humans do, but they're also stronger than humans and can take more damage. But there's something about when some of these fight scenes, I think maybe the end one was an example, was where they just, like he gets stabbed, well, like, quite a few times, I think, in this, and it takes loads of injuries. I think after a while, for me, it felt like that sort of loses its impact, where, like, there's a point in the end scene, I think, where she stabs him and it looks like he's done for and he falls over. But then you're like, oh, well, of course he's going to come back and have another go at her and drown her and all that. Because there's not much. Whereas I think maybe with the first one, where you don't know whether Decker's a replicant and he's kind of got the same vulnerability and he's up against these replicants who are sort of have these sort of superhuman qualities. And so there was more of a tension there. Whereas, and again, it's not like a deal breaker for this film, but it's just, again, one of the small things in the back of my mind is that the fight scenes, they go on, when they go on, like that last one did, it's like, well, you could just sort of stand there beating each other to a pulp for like 50 minutes. And, you know, at what point do they finally take enough damage that they actually fall over and die? You don't really know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I agree.
I'm still going off the one viewing I had two nights ago, and I would really, really like to see it again before I, like, I don't remember anything like that really striking me watching it. In fact, I don't remember any scene striking me as being too long or losing me. Like, I don't know. I was zipped in the whole time, but that's me.
No, I mean, I know.
I'm not saying, like, yeah, you know what I mean.
Yes.
I just did not get that. And you're not the only person that I've heard say that. Like, it's definitely an opinion that's out there, and that's completely valid. It just didn't really hit me that way. Mm-hmm. But, God, I mean, I really like just kind of the philosophical imagery of drowning a replicant in water in the ocean of all places. Like, that just seems like a very
another example,
subtle conscious choice.
Yeah, you know? Another example of something I think is probably totally intentional. But
I
mean, is there anything else we want to say in closing? I think we're coming up on an hour here, so
I really fucking love this movie, and I wish I could take it away from the world and run away with it.
Well, don't do that. I want to watch it again. I think this is going to be kind of like, for me, this is a lot like Mad Max Fury Road, where it's like, it's a sequel that came years later with new cast members, new director, or not new director in that case, but I guess, you know,
new energy.
It had it had a new energy to it, but it's better than it really had any right to be, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
And it's I think it's also proof that obviously this is not going to be the case every time, but I think it's proof that it's sometimes worth taking the risk in bringing back an old franchise, because it can pay off in spades.
It can. I mean, It maybe isn't if a lot of the box office headlines are to be believed. But
yeah, I mean, and I'm almost care. Yeah, no,
it's
I'm almost purely talking about just from an artistic standpoint. Like,
right,
there is a story to be told, and they told it really, really well. And even if we don't ever see it again, I feel like we have two very special films, which, you know, and just movie. There's a lot of, like, you think you go into a movie these days and you kind of know what to expect if you at least know what the genre is or who the director is or whatever. And I feel like this movie managed to kind of bypass expectations in a lot of ways. So I'm really, really excited it's out. I hope it goes on to at least break even financially. But I think it's great that it's out now and it's forever, you know, it's forever out there for our viewers. They cannot take it away from us. And I'm looking forward to watching it again. I definitely plan on seeing it in theaters at least one more time before it leaves theaters. So
yeah, for sure.
Anything you want to say in closing, George?
I like the film. And I think actually, because obviously I'm coming off of this from only having seen a couple of hours ago, but maybe after having slept on it and thought about it a bit, my opinions on some of these things might change, particularly after talking to you guys and seeing your enthusiasm for it. I mean, I think there's so much, as we've already said, to unpack about this film. There's so many ideas in it. And I guess, I don't know, it's a long film, isn't it? It's a long to take in.
Critics everywhere agree. It's a really long film.
Yeah. No, but even if it, you know, even if it isn't the most successful movie to, you know, to you or anybody who watches it, like, it's great that there's still so much to talk about, whether it worked for you on a certain level or not. Like, it's a thought-provoking movie, and I think, and honestly,
this
that's probably
really one of those ones that's gonna, like, it's going to need to age a bit, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, watch it again. Or, you know, like, even, like, I wasn't even really as hot on it as I am right now when I first walked out of the theater. I walked out of the theater and I loved it, but, like, just sitting and obsessing over it for a weekend really, really will elevate your opinion of something, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is one that's, like, I mean, I would say if you watch the movie and you didn't like it, like, you know, sit on it a few years. Go back in 5 years. Watch it again. See if, you know, see if you're different. See if it's different. See what happens. Like, this movie has potential to be one of those ones that, like, really just kind of, like, sneaks up on you way after the fact, I feel like.
Gets better,
you know?
Maybe gets better with age.
Maybe.
You never know. All right. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and conclude it here. Thank you guys for being here to talk about it. It's been a pleasure. Thank you to any of our supporters on Patreon who were spectating this recording. I know, shout out to Daniel and Prince of the Universe. Hey, look, Brad's even here spectating the recording of this. And of course, if you're a supporter on Patreon, thank you so much for supporting us. We hope you enjoy this podcast. It's going to be available to everybody else here pretty soon as well. But yeah, I look forward to the next popcorn cast. Movies are great. They're kind of like video games, but they're good in a different way. I don't know. I like them all. Thank you for listening. 4playernetwork.com is the website. We will see you next time.